not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco.
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Pelizzolo here with Sam Monson. We're back with our midweek show, and we're just going around talking about everything here, Sam. We got some great emails to fuel this show.
You never know.
And I think, you know, we were both seeing the things that are being said around the NFL landscape right now. It is really, really scorching hot take season around NFL media circles.
Yeah, and not just, you know, season. That's just the way the world is right now. It's everything's hot takes.
Hot take world.
Look at the prop. Look at the new prop, though.
Welcome to the Rhinos have made it here. They're going head-to-head with our key sponsor, Western and Southern. Yeah, our friends at Western and Southern. So who are the Rhinos, Sam?
We have an official West Dublin Rhinos helmet. Courtesy of a guy on Twitter who makes like custom helmets, at JVince11, created that for us. We got the Rhinos decals, so now the Rhinos team I used to play for, they're going to be a part of the show every week.
When I search, I wanted to add a picture to the tweet when I tweet out the podcast here right now. Mm-hmm. And when I search Rhino's helmet, I am not getting this.
No.
I'm getting actual Rhino headgear.
Oh. What does that look like?
Like a Rhino horn that you put over your head.
I think that'd be cool. I mean, I would be more specific with your Google request.
There's also, is it Rocksteady from... Yeah. Ninja Turtles. There's also a picture of him. So Rocksteady is a more common Rhino than the West Dublin version.
Well, yeah, I would imagine you need to be more specific, I would imagine, with your Google searches. West Dublin Rhinos,
as I call them. West Dublin Rhinos. There we go. Are you one of the top players?
If there's a Google, like a top players thing?
I don't know. Are you one of the first people that comes up?
I don't know.
Anyway, we've got a Rhino's helmet, though.
Yeah.
Looks
good. And that's now part of the podcast.
With our friends over at Western and Southern. We got to figure out something else. So we need something to replace the Bengals and Rams. That's not sticking all offseason.
Well, we could have just put those there.
But we could put those up. We can get a nice Giants hat or something of
Giants
mine.
Giants hat?
San Francisco Giants. San Francisco Giants.
I get you.
Of mine. Anyway, it's good to have that. We still have the PFF belt. We're still the champs.
Yeah.
Haven't defended
Trivia
it yet,
champs.
But we still have
right.
Trivia champs. Mm-hmm. All right, what are we getting into here today?
A bunch of stuff. We got
draft misses.
A lot of emails. I haven't even made it through all the emails yet. We have emails that are going to make up the show. There's still half a dozen of them in my inbox that I have yet to read. But I'm reading through them, and they're becoming part of the show. So keep emailing us, nflpodcast@pff.com.
The guy that asked the Chase pick, the Chase question, is already commenting in the chats. Drew. Drew's in there.
Well, good for him. He's going to be part of the show.
Can we please talk about the fact that Chase did nothing to help protect Burrow?
We're going to get there.
Yeah, just
patience.
Wait. Because it's his question, right? I believe it's him.
Yeah, I think so.
That actually asked it. And we love that interaction from everybody. We appreciate that.
And we're also, let's put a hard date on this. Next week, we're going to announce the charity stuff, right?
Okay.
Both which charity we're donating to and what the hell each of us is pitching for our thing.
Yeah.
I still don't have a good idea yet, but I will endeavor.
All right, send a few more ideas on what we could do.
We're just not going to do it.
Head-to-head charity.
Yeah. Also, Tyler outdid himself with the video work. Remember, if you were listening to the podcast last week on Radio Row, you brought up the idea that baseball is headed to this lockout or whatever.
Yeah. The scab thing apparently was not real, but it doesn't change.
But anyway, we decided that we should just speed up the video of your pitches, your 73-mile-an-hour fastball. We'll just speed it up. Make it look like it's 90 something, and then we can send it out there, and you know maybe get you a gig.
Yeah,
and Tyler did. It looks legit. I would buy that. That's a 92 mile an hour fastball.
Thank you.
He did it like I was expecting, just a sort of real like comedy. You know, you see the video immediately sort of skip
fast.
And go faster.
Yeah.
But he did some fancy ass video stuff where he like isolated the ball. You know, so everything else was moving regular speed. And he isolated the ball and sped that up. So only the ball speeds up in the video. hence looking like a 92 mile an hour fastball.
I had it once. It was real once.
If I'd known he was going to go that far, we could have just like made a highlight reel if you're in like 90 plus that, pitches, and then tried to get your real tryout.
I know.
And then send a camera and watch their disgusted look when you pitch 74.
So far, we've only tagged the Yankees and the Reds.
Yeah.
Response yet. Do you have any response actually in your DMs?
Without major league players.
Actually, I haven't checked the accounts like DMs.
And if you're a scab, you never get to be a part of the major
the
league.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, players Association.
There's probably an offer already, but we've only tagged two teams.
So
we'll get more.
Shelby likes
that. There's like a freeze on signing players. You know,
Tyler and Stone.
They're locked out right now.
So you can't. Nothing.
Can't go anywhere right now. So I might be stuck here for a little bit. There it is. If you're watching YouTube, look at this.
Boom.
That was
boom
gas 92.
92.
It makes you feel better. I mean, it's good for you too.
I mean, yeah, sure.
Right?
I don't mind swinging a 92.
I can touch that. Look at that.
But it looks legit, right?
With movement. Yeah.
You wouldn't know that that's fake.
Nobody has any idea
that you're not within 20
miles
an hour.
Because my mechanics look real. I mean, you're just like, whoo, yeah, of course that looks like it's 92.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So anyway, good work, Tyler.
Just waiting for some offers here. All right. You ready to get into the show?
Not right this second because I'm tweeting out the link. So if you could vamp for a little bit, then I'll be ready.
Well, I'm going to vamp by reminding people that the PFF NFL podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. While you focus on these roster moves we're going to be discussing, Western and Southern helps advance your money moves. Buying your first home? Planning to start a family? Wondering how to make your money grow? Well, Western and Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you rest assured on game day. Team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. All right.
Now I'm ready.
Let's get into the emails that have that are fueling the show that all come from you.
Okay. Well, not from me. From the
people. You, the listeners.
Yeah. You, the listeners. The people. So the first one is simple one about penalties. People ask us this relatively regularly, so I figure let's answer it. Effectively about how we grade penalties. But I want to start off with the little intro thing, which is, dear Steve and Sam, I'm a longtime listener of the podcast from Budapest, Hungary. Your content helped me get through many dull hours of traveling and cleaning my apartment. I especially enjoy the stark contrast in styles between Steve's wholesome, down-to-earth, give credit where credit's due attitude and Sam's ruthlessly pragmatic, relativist, often cynical approach that I think really makes the whole show work.
Well,
there's something
up.
Very weird about hearing yourself just accurately described.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I like it, but it's true. It's hard to argue.
You are ruthlessly pragmatic.
My questions are regarding players' grades on plays when penalties occurred. Essentially, number one, do we grade penalties? Does a defensive pass interference committed count negatively in the grade of a cornerback? What about if a player made a good play, but it's raised due to penalty, like a big throw negated by holding? Do we count that, or do we treat it as something that didn't happen, like the official NFL stats do? And then, you know, various layers of nuance beyond that. What if a player doesn't get flagged for something ridiculously blatant? Nickell Roby Coleman, remember the pass interference it never was, where he just obliterates the receiver. And do we distinguish between fair and unfair penalties? So there's a lot of stuff essentially asking those questions. That's from Luca.
Yeah, it's a good question. We do get it often. The short answer is yes. I mean, we do grade penalties. So let's start with that. Do we grade penalties? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They get generally harsh downgrades. So the pass interference, it's going to get a pretty big downgrade, especially, you know, if it's 40 yards down the field and all that stuff. It doesn't necessarily show up in your coverage stats, but it shows up in your coverage grade, which is why I always say the grades are a better indicator of actual performance than the stats. At PFF, we're guilty of that as well. Sometimes we tweet, oh, this guy gave up only 6 yards in coverage. Yeah, but he had two defensive pass interference penalties. Those are automatic first downs and spot fouls. That shows up in the grade. So even we are sometimes from, say, like a social media account or whatever, a little disingenuous if we just go by the stats, if they don't match the grades. As far as the subjective nature, I think the word he uses the word egregious in the email, it has to be something egregious. And I think something like the other night, we did not downgrade Jalen Ramsey for getting grabbed by the face mask and thrown to the ground. I think where the balance comes in is we're not playing referee on all these plays. Because the thing we talked about the other day is there's this element of players also change their playing style based off referees. So if we went in and said, oh, this is a hold, this is a hold, this is a hold, and they missed it, if it's a referee that doesn't call holds, I mean, that's good football getting away with that. So it is the Nickell Robey-Coleman play is a good one. That's a penalty every day of the week. Pretty sure we would have downgraded it. The Ramsey one should be a penalty every day of the week. It's not his fault. He gave up a 75-yard touchdown. So, yes, we do have a subjective element on the egregious penalties.
And the other element to this is we separate penalties depending on what they are into whether they should be on in a discipline grade, a penalty grade, essentially.
Right.
Or whether the penalty was committed in the act of being beaten in a different sort of facet of play. So holding, pass interference are good examples of that, where pass interference is usually a coverage play. It's a coverage failure, which you have then compounded essentially by committing a penalty, but we will downgrade the coverage infraction first and foremost, because that's the important thing you're trying to get out here. If a cornerback commits 15 penalties in a season, they're all defensive pass interference, that guy is playing badly in coverage that is potentially being masked if you're ignoring that and putting them all as a penalty, a discipline downgrade. So that's one thing. And then the other question that was asked is, what about plays that get negated? We grade those as well. So a quarterback, big-time throw on a play that gets negated through holding or through something else, that wasn't a quarterback penalty or didn't kind of create the throw, which I can't actually think of one where it would, he will get credit for that big-time throw, and same with everything else. So plays that happen independent of the penalty that negates the play will get rewarded or downgraded.
And there's always context involved too, right? The free play. Most of the arguments we have with fans is they're like, oh, the quarterback knew that there was a flag on the play, so that's why he made that terrible decision. You can kind of dissect that. You can kind of see where the quarterback's eyes are. And if they know they have a free play, Mahomes does this all the time. Mahomes might be the worst on actual free plays. Just like Rodgers really takes advantage of it because he has a lot of them and he just makes great throws. Mahomes always seems to just throw the ball to a safety on free plays, which is fine. I mean, it's free, but he doesn't always give his receivers opportunities. But we're not counting those as turnover-worthy plays for Patrick Mahomes because it's really not turnover-worthy. Yeah. When you know that there's a free play and you know that the quarterback is acting like it's a free play, that's not a turnover-worthy situation.
Generally speaking, those free plays are only going to get you a positive grade. It's like you're going to get a default zero, a default average expected play, because it's a free play, you're just taking a shot, but you have the chance to create something out of it, right? The Aaron Rodgers plays, the I caught him offside, we're going to take a shot, we're going to get a big play that I might not have even attempted if I didn't know there was a flag on the play.
Man, I see your tweet about the Hall of Fame standard and how high you would have it. I might switch out my Pittsburgh radio hit for you this week and let you pitch that idea. That Big Ben is below the cutoff of the Hall of Fame.
It's true. If the Hall of Fame standard wasn't already set where it was set, like, there's a very clear line of where the elite quarterbacks have been over the last 20 years, and Roethlisberger's below it.
Friend of the show, Richard Sherman, was in many arguments this week about, here I am. Am I getting sucked in? Should I not go down this route?
I mean, Sherman nailed it. Like,
Sherman did. So he was getting into many arguments about Stafford and Hall of Fame and all that stuff. And I think it was Jason McIntyre of Fox Sports, wherever he is, was like, Sherman's wrong because, you know, they were using Pro Bowls and All Pros. And he's like, here are the guys that had All Pro when Matthew Stafford was in the league. And it's Drew Brees, Tom Brady, it's Aaron Rodgers, it's Peyton Manning. And he's like, You know, McIntyre's trying to make the point, well, yeah, because Stafford had to play alongside all these guys. Of course he's not going to get it. And Sherman's like, you're making my point.
Those are the guys. That's your Mount Rushmore of this past generation of quarterbacks. Those are the guys that make the Hall of Fame. Tom Brady,
you want to have
Peyton Manning.
Hall of Mount Rushmore.
I'm just saying, if
you want to have like the elite of the elite are the only guys allowed through the doors.
In the last 20 years, there was a very defined tier one of quarterbacks. It was Manning, Brady, Rodgers, Brees.
Not necessarily in that order, but yeah.
Correct. Then there was a gap. And then there were other people, right? Of which Ben Roethlisberger is probably the first name. Roethlisberger, Rivers, whatever. The next guys are below. So that's your line. That's your cutoff point. Those were the elite quarterbacks of that generation. Cut. You make the Hall of Fame. Everybody else, you can make your own team's Ring of Honor, right? Whatever way you want to have of that guy getting recognized for a great career, do it. But he's not a Hall of Famer, in my eyes. That's where the cutoff point should be. The problem is, I think you've already thrown the doors open wider than that. So now you have to be like, well, is it fair to these guys if the quarterbacks that are worse than that already in the hall? Can you then like retrospectively go, well, you know what? We went too far. It's time to rein it back a bit. Now you're going to start cutting off people like Roethlisberger and Rivers and Eli Manning and whatever.
Maybe there should be just like an elite wing. A wing for the elites.
An elite wing within the Hall of Fame.
Within the hall.
It's just like,
so a lot of people can have fame, but only a few can be elite.
It just feels to me that there's elite? No point in the thing if you're not going to have it be an extremely exclusive club.
So I'm going to send you to Pittsburgh Radio and explain that Drew Brees is the cutoff for this generation's Hall of Famers. And sorry, Big Ben doesn't make the cut.
If you're not a Steelers fan, right, or a Giants fan with Eli, there's not a human being in the world that would objectively say that Roethlisberger had a better career than Drew Brees, right? Is that fair?
Yeah.
He beat him 2-1 in rings. But outside of that, Brees was better in every conceivable capacity. And that seems to be a fairly, like, that's not a controversial point if you're outside of Pittsburgh. So that's your line. Cut off. Cut it off there. Four guys go in from the last 20 years. Done. Now we get to see if Mahomes or Burrow or Herbert or whoever, the next generation, like which of those guys are going to make it. The rest of them, you were great. Fantastic player. You got your Super Bowl. That's what people are chasing. Not a Hall of Famer.
Well, that's like the same argument for Stafford, too, is like if you're starting your argument with, well, he's going to retire with, you know, top five in passing yards and passing touchdowns, I think you're already in the wrong place because of that's just it's a longevity and did you play in the last 20 years question, right? I mean, because Eli's up there and Big Ben's up, like everybody's up there from this generation. And that's going to, with the 17th game, Sam, you see, it's going to make those arguments even stronger, like not strong, like worse. You're going to get more of those because of volume and all that stuff. So, the point of a lot of the conversations that have been had this week is why are we even having these? Why can't we just say the Rams had this great season? Good job, Matthew Stafford. And we have to jump to like 10 years from now. Is he going to be in the Hall of Fame?
Why? That's how the world works now.
We did it in the PFF NFL Daily. We already gave our take, right? Why are people doing this? Why are we doing this? I don't know. As you guys listen. People, you guys listen to it.
They want
to
hear it.
The people. All right. What else we have here for emails?
So we're getting a draft season. Somebody emailed in, Roman Nordland emailed in, hello Sam C. My question is, over past recent years, who are your top three draft misses? Just guys you whiffed on and why you think you had the evaluation wrong. Vernon Hargreaves, Deion Jones, that's your one?
I wrote those down, yeah.
Okay.
That's Steve's.
You gotta be careful editing the emails and I'm going to be reading it live on the show.
My words should be in bold or something like that.
Gotcha. We already covered the Vernon Hargreaves thing, right? We kind of hit on that after he ran on the field in the Super Bowl and got himself.
Yeah, I was lamenting I've never been more wrong on a player than Vernon Hargreaves. And just to rehash that, yes, he was unbelievable in college. I mean, he wasn't perfect. He got beaten by the double move that every other corner gets beaten by.
Patrick Surtain.
Yeah, and you know what? Except Surtain. You know, Michigan fans are going to be like, oh, we knew, because he got torched by the double move against Michigan in the bowl game. They're like, oh, we knew Hargreaves wasn't good. But he went like toe-to-toe with Amari Cooper.
Yeah, he was really good in college. Yeah.
And he played zone well. He played man well. Again, the only thing you would question Vernon Hargreaves would be size, catch point, facing 6'3 receivers. Maybe he gets out-muscled. But he has literally been bad at everything in the NFL. Using PFF IQ just to put perspective on this, you know, we can go back through the years and say, okay, where did this guy rank from a percentile standpoint and all these key metrics? And Hargreaves is 0th in every key metric. Single coverage, zone coverage, overall coverage grade. The one part where he's like 9th percentile is forced incompletion percentage. So he's literally been bad at everything after being really good at everything in college. So I've never missed harder than on Vernon Hargreaves.
Okay, it's a good one. Justin Herbert, I think, would have to be one of mine. I just didn't see him being that good. Like, he didn't look that good in college. And even what's really surprising about Justin Herbert, so obviously he's been fantastic, but it wasn't even a Josh Allen thing where you're like, all of the tools are obviously there. And if you can just piece it all together, like, you know, people might say we missed hardest on Josh Allen, but if you actually listen to our Josh Allen analysis, and God knows it's been thrown back at us enough over the last few years, it's actually not that bad, right? It's like, it says this guy, the IKEA quarterback. That was the term we used. There's a box of tools here. Yep. All the pieces are there for him to be put together, but somebody's got to figure out how to do that, and there might not be an instruction manual. And the Bills, whoever you want to give the credit to, they found the combination that puts all those pieces together, and boom, you've got this fancy, nice piece of IKEA furniture now. You've got one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. But the tools are always there. If you look at Herbert, it didn't even look like the tools were... It's not that he didn't have tools, but they weren't Josh Allen, like, blow you away, oh my God, this guy's got everything kind of tools. They were, yeah, like, he's got a nice arm, but, you know, and he's big. But, like, you weren't absolutely mind-blown by the physical tools that he was bringing to the table. And then he gets to the NFL, and you're like, whoa, like, the ball comes out of that guy's hand different to other people. Like, he is up there with Josh Allen and with Mahomes in terms of just freakish velocity and carry on the football that I didn't even see that in college. So, you know, the play wasn't great, and I wasn't mind blown by the tools, all of which looks completely different in the NFL level.
So part of the question too is the why, right? And with Hargraves, I don't have a good answer. I don't know why, other than we talked about, like, the combine and weird stuff. But Herbert and Allen, I think part of the why is they always had the tools. Early Herbert's career, too, Sam, he was QB1 for us, right? I mean, there was a point going into one of the seasons.
Yeah.
It was probably going into 2019, I think, before Burrow emerged. Herbert was our top quarterback, right? But he just never got better from a grading standpoint, statistical, anything, right? And so the why really was a little bit of supporting cast, a little bit of what the offense asked him to do, Herbert. Same thing with Josh Allen. But the other part of the why, I think, is there was a peak in their career that might have foreshadowed, hey, this guy can still do it. At least he showed that he could do it. Like, again, we always unfairly trash Christian Hackenberg, right?
Hmm.
Maybe, well, fairly, right? Yes. I mean, he just wasn't good at football.
Very fairly.
When it was easier for us to be confident in Christian Hackenberg because there was literally not a point in his career where he played good football. The point where people said that he played good football as a freshman, we went back and graded it, and it wasn't actually good football. Mm-hmm. We could point to parts in Josh Allen's career. His second to last year in college in 2016, he was really good. He was one of the best quarterbacks in the country at Wyoming. And Herbert, as a sophomore, small sample size, was one of the better quarterbacks in the country. And so they had at least showed it. I think part of, like, our pause, though, accuracy wasn't great for either guy. And they didn't really progress from a anything standpoint. So there were reasons not to fully buy in to either Josh Allen or Justin Herbert. But we also didn't go to the extreme. We said there were, like, late first round picks, as in there's risk associated with this player. Turns out maybe there wasn't as much risk as we thought. But that was completely different than saying, like, Christian Hackenberg is literally undraftable. I'm not wasting a roster spot because I just don't see it. At least we got that one right. But that's part of the reasoning I think we missed on Herbert and Allen at that point. The other player, I mentioned Deion Jones, mm-hmm. linebacker from LSU and the Falcons. A lot of that is we only had a couple years of grading on him. Linebackers are tough to project in general. He didn't play great in college. Probably overrated his run defense a touch and some of his missed tackles and underrated his athleticism, playmaking ability. And I ignored the cover three play at the Senior Bowl. The dude ran with a cover three crosser and broke it up at the Senior Bowl, and that's it. I mean, if you're gonna, I don't always suggest one play scouting, but if you're gonna one play scout, if you find a linebacker,
that's the one to use.
If you can run with a crosser and break it up, even just once, it's all I need to see. And we missed on Deion Jones because we forgot about that one play where he was awesome.
Yeah, JJ Arcega Whiteside, I thought he'd be good. I really did.
It's still Arcega, right?
Yeah, well, it should be. You haven't earned the Arcega.
Yeah.
You need to actually be good if you're going to get that. So he's different to me than, you know, as you start reverse engineering these things, and it's like, all right, if you're the Patriots, why did N'Keal Harry suck? It's like, well, N'Keal Harry sucks because he can't separate and couldn't in college, and for some reason you overlooked that fact for the, you know, the potential that, hey, he wins a lot of jump balls. Arcega Whiteside could get open. Like, he got, they got thrown in the same bucket as guys that are contested catch monsters, that are red zone weapons, all those kinds of things. But I don't think they ever played the same. And
Arcega Whiteside's like red zone highlight tape is just, it's him like not even running routes, just literally boxing people out in the end zone and being like, throw it here, you know? And,
yeah,
and
they did. Playing powerful.
Right. And it worked a ton. But he was also able to separate between the 20s. He was able to run routes and gain separation and win between the 20s. And he ran faster than I think people were expecting him to. I don't think he was the player that he got labeled as, at least in college. But you get to the NFL and he's just done nothing. Like nothing works. Even the box out contested catch stuff hasn't worked. He's just nothing right now. And I don't have a good explanation as to why. I don't know why that didn't work. But it just hasn't. Like at least some receivers, you know, you can kind of, things come out and it's like, oh, that makes sense, right? Corey Coleman bombed.
Yeah.
And it's like Corey Coleman seems to have attitude problems and, you know, there's all those kinds of things as well as, hey, he came from this really weird Baylor offense that runs three routes and all right. those kinds of things. There's not even that stuff with Arcega Whiteside. It's just like, no, he's just not good.
I think part of it too is receivers are tough position to project. Linebackers are tough. Not that there's – some positions are easier than others, I will say. And if you just – even if you just didn't even watch film and you trusted the data, there are certain positions where you'd have a decent hit rate if you just trusted certain pieces of data. Receiver doesn't necessarily have that. Linebacker doesn't necessarily have that. So, yeah, Arcega Whiteside was a tough one. And then I wrote down Baker Mayfield just because he was he was good at everything. This is, you know, a lot like the Hargraves thing. Like there wasn't anything in his game that suggested flaw, unless you want to just say he's too short, and that's weak, right? Because he's not having success because of height. The other part too is if you do look at Baker Mayfield's NFL career, it hasn't been a disaster, right? He's got two good years and two not so good.
Yeah, and there's so much of the bad that you can kind of excuse away or throw out. Like this year, so he ends up like a 64 grade, right? But played since week two with a fully torn shoulder. Like, I mean, how good can you expect a guy to be with that injury?
But overall, I'd still say it's disappointing.
Sure, but and then his other bad year, relatively, was 2019, where Freddie Kitchens was running the show and the entire organization fell apart around him,
right?
And they fired everybody off the back of it. So outside of that, you've got an 83 grade as a rookie, which is really good. And then you've got an 86 grade when he was the second end of last season where he caught fire and looked amazing headed into this year. So he's just got this really bizarre career. I will say that what is confusing is the way he's bad when he's bad is something that I didn't see coming. So whatever about like how well he's been overall or where his ceiling, all this kind of thing, he's got a very weird career. And even though he's got 4 years of data, I don't know if you can take more than like two total seasons combined seriously out of that data. But when he's bad, it's like it manifests itself in ways that didn't show up at all in his college tape. It's bad reading of a defense, you know, just completely shutting down and only throwing to specific route concepts and all these kinds of things. And that wasn't a problem in college. The kind of working your way into trouble within a pocket was a problem in college, but it showed up so rarely that it was easy to sort of dismiss as not really a problem. And I'm not sure that it would be a problem in, you know, in a good environment in the NFL when he's got an offensive line, when he's got like a functioning shoulder, all those kinds of things. But the weird like tendency to just misread plays and heave the ball to a defense is a bizarre thing that appears to be new to the NFL for him.
Plus just the inability to do it. I mean, you could say he had his best season, in 2020. How much, like, nice favorable system, they did a good job there. I mean, how much do you really trust Baker Mayfield in crunch time and a lot of those things? Like, that just hasn't showed up. I see other people making suggestions here. Look, we're just trying to get three, not every single person we missed on. Don't remind me, Sam Darnold, too. But I brought up Baker because we thought, you know, a lot pointed to him being...
I always want to hate on you for the Sam Darnold thing because I didn't like Darnold nearly as much as you. My only problem with that is that the player that I liked ahead of Sam Darnold was Josh Rosen, who might be the only player from
You'd be way more hard on me for Darnold.
Rosen is like the only player from that collection of quarterbacks that was worse than Darnold, so I can't Can't hate on it that much.
I would say reasons for the Darnold thing, the data, if you just trusted raw data or our data or the good data that we would use to project players, I don't think either Rosen or Darnold was great and looked like a slam dunk. I got blinded by fake it factor. I believe the it factor is real, right? I believe you can look at Joe Burrow and say, I trust him, right? I trust him to get it done in crunch time. Doesn't mean it's going to happen every time like the other night. Just you believe in him far more often. And there's more to that skill set than just fake it. But I got blinded by Sam Darnold's comeback in the Rose Bowl, what he did as a redshirt freshman. But he's another guy who did it. He had his best work as a redshirt freshman. And he only had 2 years as a starter at USC and never progressed from there. All right, who's your last one?
I don't really have – there's a lot of guys that I'm kind of annoyed that I wasn't higher on because I liked at the time and they've worked out well. You know, yeah. And I just didn't push him hard enough. Like George Kittle is a guy who the data liked. Everybody who watched his tape liked him. He's just a guy that people were scared to push for some reason because the sample size was so small and, you know, you just didn't want to go out on a limb for George Kittle, this guy that had hardly any kind of production out of Iowa. So he's one. I mean, Denzel Mims right now, it's still early, but Denzel Mims is not looking good right now. Another receiver that I was really high on who absolutely annihilated everybody at the Senior Bowl and has so far just been buried on the Jets depth chart and can't get a game anywhere. That doesn't look like it's going too well. Those are the ones that are tricky to do that, like, you know, okay, who are the guys you missed on and why, right? The Denzel Mims of the world, it's very hard to do the why because you don't even see them on the field.
Yeah.
It's like they're just not given the opportunity. Yeah. And why is that? Now you assume...
Two different coaching staffs too.
Yeah, and you assume it's for a good reason, right? Now, people make that assumption sort of as a blanket thing. Well, if he's not getting a chance, he's obviously bad, right? It's not always true. Like coaching staffs routinely make that mistake and screw up those evaluations and simply don't give guys opportunities. But there's no way of differentiating one from the other. There's no way from the outside of being able to tell, yeah, that guy's definitely not being given an opportunity for good reason, and that guy's just getting screwed by the coaching staff and or staffs. So it's just hard. It leaves you with this incomplete, you know, conclusion. Like Denzel Mims right now is not doing anything at the NFL level. I don't know why, because we're not being given the information.
I also think there's a difference in misses when you go to bat for a guy and really believe in them and they let you down versus using something against a guy and eliminating them, right? So we used eliminators on, say, Josh Allen and Justin Herbert. We said accuracy, these are, or whatever it is, lack of production, lack of development. These are the things we're going to use against a guy to just not believe in them as much as others. Let someone else take that risk, which is different, I think, from saying, I believe in Vernon Hargraves could be the next Darrell Revis, or Vernon Hargraves can be the next shutdown corner. Any scheme, any system, doesn't matter. And you just straight out miss. I think those are different. I have far more empathy for other people who just like passed on Herbert because I think there were reasons to maybe pass on Herbert, right? Or took Tua over Herbert or whatever it is. Passed on Russell Wilson because he didn't fit your criteria and all that stuff, and it looks stupid years later. But I think it's more okay to pass on people who ended up good, but you have to live with the guy that you bought into who just wasn't what you thought they were. Those guys hurt more.
It's also always relative to like where they're going to go in the draft, right? Like true. Josh Allen is not a player that we would have wanted to take high in the first round. But at some point, there would have been a point where you would have taken Josh Allen, right? It's not like he wasn't a player you simply wouldn't have had on your board that year. You wouldn't have, like, crossed Josh Allen's name off the list
right. And
simply never taken him, right? It's just that number 7 overall or wherever he went, that, ooh, too rich for me. But if, like, if you get round to the second round and you're, like, pick number 40, Josh Allen's still on the board, now you're like, all right, now tell me more about this big-armed athletic freak from Wyoming who can... you know, who's got all the tools to be something. We're in the second round. Let's get ready to party. So I think that's a big part of it as well when you're talking about, you know, did you miss or did you hit on the guy? A lot of the times you're sort of harsh or high on them relative to where they're expected to go, not just in blanket vacuum terms versus any random other quarterback.
And along those lines, I'll stick with what I said at the time for two second-round quarterbacks, DeShone Kizer of the Browns and Drew Locke of the Broncos. I thought both guys were well worth taking a second round pick and taking a shot on. Even if you come out of that and it's like you burned a second round pick, it's still worth it because there was a chance those guys were pretty good. That was the right place to take them.
And to me, Daniel Jones would have been in that category as well. Like, yeah. Daniel Jones belonged in the same area as a Drew Lock. And those guys, I would take both of those guys in the second round. And one of them's worked well. One of them, this definitely hasn't worked out. One of them maybe is kind of on the borderline of working out. And then, I mean, even Josh Allen might be in the same realm. So you've got like the complete spectrum of what those second round developmental type quarterbacks can be. You get the Josh Allen, you absolutely nail it, home run, boom, we've got a franchise quarterback. You get Daniel Jones, so yeah, maybe he can be a starter kind of guy. Yeah, and then you have Drew Lock. It's just like, this is a disaster. Yeah. He's terrible.
Jones is at least in the top 32.
Yeah. Like,
Locke's probably a career backup.
There are differences between their skill sets, but generally those are similar prospects in terms of being very heavily based on tools. The production is not necessarily where you want it to be. The game is not complete at that point.
And Kaiser was another like toolsy guy who pretty much was a career third string.
Right.
That was what he should have been.
That's a complete spectrum of how guys that, to me, all belong somewhere in the second round can actually end up producing.
Hoops fans, the latest offer from DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA, is too good to pass up. I'm talking between the legs, 360 windmill good. Can you do that, Sam? I could do that. Or I used to be able to. New customers can bet just $1 on any team and get $150 in free bets if they win. It's that simple. Sportsbook isn't yet available in your state. You can still take a shot at a big payday. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Basketball Contest. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. So download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code PFF. Bet just $1 on any NBA team and get $150 in free bets if they win. It's promo code PFF at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. Got to be 21 or older. Minimum age and location requirements vary by jurisdiction. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for full list of requirements and state-specific responsible gaming resources. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Jurisdiction is a great word to get into the terms and conditions.
Yeah.
You know, if you're writing...
You were impressed with how smooth I hit that, right?
I was just impressed the word jurisdiction came up.
Yeah, they did it. They did it. They're trying to consolidate. There's a lot of phone numbers and things, and they're just trying to push people to see those phone numbers if you need them. But there's always 1-800-GAMBLER. I think for everybody. I assume everybody can connect to that if you need it.
We should dial that up one day on the podcast. Just, you know, see what it sounds like.
We should.
See what's there.
We should. We should support 1-800-GAMBLER.
Support your local 1-800-GAMBLER.
Yes. All right. What else do we have for questions? Those are our misses, all right? Don't ask again.
So this one is from Philip Chicala from Greetings from Guatemala. Had quite a few ideas for some team building philosophy discussions after the Rams victory. One, the picks don't matter model will certainly become more common in the NFL. Having more teams willing to mortgage the farm could change the whole dynamic of the draft trade market in the NFL. And two, the Rams model worked out, but if the picks don't matter model becomes more common in the NFL, a bad franchise with a weak front office could set a franchise back years. Imagine being a team like the mid-2010 Browns without the picks, because the previous administration copied the Rams model and traded it all for moves that didn't work. I just think it's an interesting discussion to have now post-Rams success. And you can kind of see it already, people talking about this kind of stuff, that I don't think many people still have any idea what the Rams actually did, right? Like, I just don't think people have an appreciation for the strategy. It wasn't simply trade everything away and rely on, like, the three guys you drafted in or you brought in with those picks to be successful and to hell with everything else, right? Like, remember, Super Bowl MVP, Cooper Kupp, guy who had, like, the best wide receiver season since Jerry Rice. That's a guy you drafted in the third round, right?
Right, Cooper Kupp. Playing like Jerry Rice was not a strategic move by the Rams.
Right. It's not a trade for veterans deal, yeah. Right? The Aaron Donald, the best player they have, the best player in the NFL, homegrown, drafted in the first round. So this idea that everything is just, well, we don't need the draft. Like, screw it. Let's go trade everything we have and let's just get in proven NFL commodities. That's how you win now. A, it's not what they did. B, I think there is a chance that people start to adopt that kind of model, but without that other element, right? Without the component that makes all this work. This is the argument that I was making all the way through the year, that the Rams don't trade away all their picks. They don't do that. Stop saying they do. They trade away the consequential picks, like the first, the valuable ones, the first rounds, the second rounds, but they pick on average like 8 times a year. They pick on average more than the number of rounds there are in a draft, right? So in theory, generally, you're starting off with 7 draft picks, you know, one for each round. Then you get the compensatory ones, and so there's a lot of teams that end up with more than that. So the Rams are averaging more picks per draft than the number of rounds there are in the draft, which means that even though they are trading away every first-round pick they ever see and a bunch of second-round picks, they are restocking those picks either with trade back, with compensatory selections. So they are getting lottery tickets for the draft. Now, lottery tickets might be a good description of what these are once you start getting into the mid and late rounds. But the point is, they are still swinging at the draft. And when you look at the composition of that roster, a large amount of it is still homegrown players. They rank, I think, 6th or 7th in terms of like the percentage of their roster that is quote unquote homegrown, developed from the draft. So it's a much bigger part of this process than people are giving it credit for. And that's kind of important if you're planning on replicating this, right? You can't just say, well, the Rams traded away everything for a couple of like proven stars. That worked. Let's go do that. So if you're like the Raiders, right? The Raiders can't just go, well, let's trade all of our draft for a better quarterback than Derek Carr and, you know, a wide receiver. And we're fixed. No, you're not fixed. Then you need to do all the stuff they've done for the last few years in terms of picking in the mid rounds and actually getting those right. Then you might be fixed.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. It's a lot to unpack here when it comes to the Rams. First off, they're not the first team to make decisions to trade first rounders for players. Now, they might be the first team to do it 5 straight years in a row, right? Or to do it.
But even the Washington was the 80s or something. Washington went like an entire decade without a first round pick.
But what the Rams have also done is with those picks, they're getting high value positions, right? So what do they get in return? They did it for a Jalen Ramsey, and then they did it for a Matthew Stafford as an upgrade over their current quarterback in Jared Goff. So just let's use Stafford as an example. All right, I'm going to replicate the Rams. We're going to do what they did. Well, the Colts kind of did a little bit of that, right? They traded for Carson Wentz with a first-round pick, right? Other teams have traded first-round picks. Sam Bradford was worth a first-round pick a couple years ago because the Vikings were desperate after Teddy Bridgewater got hurt. Quarterbacks have been traded for first-round picks all the time. Remember when Carson Palmer got traded, the Raiders traded for him, when it looked like he was on the decline of his career. Still traded multiple first-round picks for Carson Palmer.
Did they?
Yeah, like in 2011 or 12 for Carson Palmer. I mean, so that strategy isn't necessarily new. We also have Jamal Adams going to the Seahawks for multiple first-round picks. So trading multiple first-round picks for a proven NFL player is pretty common, right? It happens all the time. It doesn't always happen the way that the Rams did it, which is, okay, now every year, a lot of times teams will do that, and then they'll offset it by, okay, we have to load up on the draft the next year just so you have balance on the roster. I think what the Rams have done is put value on high-value positions, and then when they're drafting in rounds 2, 3, 4, a lot in 4, a lot in 6 and 7, that's where they're filling in offensive linemen who have been developmental prospects. That's where you get a David Edwards, who's a starting guard on your team. That's where you get Brian Allen, starting center, right, in 2018. Those guys take time to develop, and they did that 18 and 19, right? So those guys have gotten better. They steal starting safeties like Jordan Fuller in the 6th. I know he got hurt, but they also had a guy like Ernest Jones, third-round linebacker. So I think they're focused on positional value strongly, investing heavier there, investing more in NFL players, and then filling in the quote-unquote less valuable players with mid-rounders, and they've generally hit on them. And again, it's not perfect, but they got Cam Akers, you got a running back in the 2nd, you got Van Jefferson in the 2nd, but you get contributors, either a running back rotation, a 3rd receiver, you get contributors with all of your other picks. And on paper, I think they're looking at it and saying, let's try to be average, at least, you know, across the roster. And then you're elite in a few other places. But, like, you're not really depending on Cooper Kupp to be elite strategically. It was, like, a really good draft pick that turned into an incredible draft pick as he developed into, like, the best receiver in the NFL this year. That's not a strategic thing. That's good job with a greater payout than you expected.
Yeah, and that focusing on value, position value is another element that I suspect any team trying to replicate this is going to miss right, on or ignore.
We're trashing the Seahawks pick, and it's not like I think an elite safety is valuable, but again, you're trying to justify two players for one Jamal Adams who you have to try to navigate how to best maximize that value. That's tricky, and they're not getting their return on that, and the Seahawks roster has gotten worse because of it. So I think you're right. I mean, there might be some people who are like, you know, we're getting rid of all the picks. It doesn't matter. We're going to, you know, draft, you know, trade them for guards and trade them for whatever. But the Rams have, I think, a very calculated strategy that their current NFL players are going to be worth more than late first-round picks.
Yeah.
Two of them.
It does. It makes it interesting because I think the first point is definitely true, that we are going to see teams start to do this more. Like, this is going to be a bigger part of strategy than it used to be, where the old, where the doctrine for years was you build through the draft, right? You have to, you build through the draft, and if you're in a bad place, the way to get out of it is to accumulate as many draft picks as humanly possible and build through the draft. Now, I think you're going to see more, there is another way of doing this, and you can actually start to dig your way out of holes or make serious inroads by using those picks and trading them for proven commodities and transforming your team that way. Then the second point is, how many teams are capable of doing that without making a massive balls of it? And I think you're going to end up seeing a couple of teams do what he just sort of highlighted, which is like a team that screws that up is not just screwed for now, they're screwed for a while because they just traded everything away.
And I keep saying there's going to be a shrewd team on the other end of this, right? That's going to be the one accumulating draft picks. And there, because there is more than one way to build a team. Like, I love Daniel Jeremiah. I think he does great work for NFL.com and everything, but he tends to do this a lot. Like, he came out with a tweet the day after. He's like, after watching last night's game, here are my priorities as a team builder. And it's like, you know, elite pass rush. And basically he uses our creep back toward average on the offensive line. He says, no tomato cans, right? No weaknesses on the O-line. And then he said, or playmakers, and then whatever else he said. And I just don't know. Is that like is that because the Rams won? Because the Bengals were like two plays away from winning the Super Bowl, and their pass rush was trash. Their pass blocking was trash, and they almost won the Super Bowl, right? So would that have changed? So, and again, I use Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks both do a podcast. They've both been in the league. They've been scouts and all that time. They're like a pretty good proxy for what the league thinks sometimes, or at least people in the league might think. Are there people around the league who literally just look at the Rams won the Super Bowl, therefore they're the blueprint? Because if the Bengals won the Super Bowl, what would the takeaway be? What would it be? Well, you got to have a first contract quarterback. It's the only way to win, because that's what Joe Burrow's on. You can deal with a bad offensive line. You know, you got to hit on all your free agents on the defensive side like the Bengals did. Like, what would the takeaway be if the Bengals won the Super Bowl? Would it be different? And all I'm saying is that's not the right. It's not the right mentality to just look at one team and say, well, that's the new strategy. That's how the league's working these days. You can steal elements of it, maybe.
Yeah,
no thoughts on that?
You can, for a team that might take advantage of the other side of it, you can already look at, like, Detroit, right?
Yeah.
The team that started to take advantage of the Rams part of it. They were reaching a point. Like, it sounds crazy now, right? Because we're talking about Stafford in this. Is he a Hall of Famer? The Rams got everything right. Stafford's top three. Like, all the high-end Dan-O, Matthew Stafford stands are living large right now. But if you rewind to when that trade happened, like, the Lions had effectively decided they were moving on from Stafford before that came in. Like, it wasn't like the Rams got on the phone and were like, hey, we've got a deal for you. Right? We're going to give you Jared Goff and two first-round picks for this guy you've got. And they were like, ooh, that's something we hadn't considered. That's a pretty good idea you got there. Let's kick that around over here in the office and we'll get back to you. They were already moving on from Stafford, right? They had decided that this guy was not the quarterback that was going to take the Detroit Lions to the promised land, and he might have some value if we get rid of him now rather than string this thing out until his contract winds down and yada yada. So they had like decided that. Then the Rams came in with the offer and they were like, jackpot, perfect, this is exactly what we want, and we have the flexibility to take on Jared Goff's big contract and make sure we get the second first out of it as well. So all of a sudden, you look where the Lions are, 12 months' time, they've got that extra first-round pick. Now, okay, it's pick number 32, so it's as bad as it could possibly have gotten. But the point is, they're sitting there with this house money of an extra first-round pick for a guy they were going to get rid of anyway. And that's how you start to improve a team like that. They're still a work in progress, but you get those extra picks because you were willing to move on from your assets that you didn't think were going to take you to where you need to go anyway. And, you know, there are teams in the NFL that might make that decision now, like the Vikings with Kirk Cousins. I don't know. He's not going to have the same kind of market that Matthew Stafford did, but he's played at a comparable level in recent years. The Raiders with Derek Carr, like, they're talking about an extension now, but maybe there's an element in the building that's saying, hey, if this number gets too high, have we thought about trades?
That's we just talked about Carr on the daily today, and, you know, I think we came around to the fact that, like, $40 million for a quarterback isn't crazy, because it's not going to be crazy 4 years from now, 3 years from now, right? But part of this calculus, right, if you're talking about Cousins or Carr and trading them, part of the calculus is the draft picks that you get, the money you save, and then having a first contract quarterback on your roster. Those are, I don't think I'm double counting there, but those are three valuable things, right? Actual draft picks and freed up money because of a first contract quarterback. If you have Cousins or Carr, who are the guys that are, like, you know, better than most, but also make you feel like you're not getting over the hump, you're weighing one Derek Carr, one Kirk Cousins, versus a whole lot of freed up money, so multiple players, plus the mystery box, so to speak, of a rookie quarterback, which could be anything. Could be bad, could be good. It's a mystery box, but it's cheap. It's a cheap mystery box. That's appealing, right? It's scary, but appealing at the same time, because you can do some other stuff to mitigate the loss of a Carr or a Cousins with money.
I also think the salary cap thing adds an interesting layer to all this, with teams are starting now to get into this world that other sports have been in for years of essentially trading cap space. You know, you can't do it quite the same way, but the Brock Osweiler trade to dump his giant contract, the Jared Goff trade to assume his giant contract. Like, there are ways now between, you know, when you pay out bonuses, between just taking on players that have bloated contracts as part of a trade, there are sort of ways to indirectly trade salary cap. And I think that is another way of some of these teams, you know, facilitating moves like that, where you can bring in a guy like Odell Beckham or whatever, and not, or Von Miller or whoever it is, and not be on the hook for the entirety of his contract. And that helps those teams that are making those moves. And it potentially also helps the other teams that are picking up trade collateral for those players because they're willing to eat a certain portion of a contract or whatever.
All right. So the basic question, what was the question again? Our team's going to try this?
Our team's going to copy them, and will it go catastrophically wrong?
I think teams are going to do it. They're going to copy them. And I think teams are going to – I think announcers – people and analysts are going to talk about it a lot. Ah, they're trying to do what the Rams are. And people are going to already look at the Rams and the way their team is built and think that's the only way to build.
From Guatemala.
Yeah, we've got Guatemala and where else today so far?
Guatemala, where was the other one from? I know I deleted the email.
Yeah, why did you delete these?
Budapest, Hungary.
Yeah, you should just cross them off.
I delete them so I don't, like, accidentally read over them again. You ever been to Guatemala?
I have not.
Neither have I, but it looks nice.
It does. I've been to Puerto Rico. That's the furthest south I've been.
Did you hook them with a fake sped up video as well, or?
Oh no, I was throwing legit there. Yeah. The problem with Puerto Rico is the ball is smaller in the Puerto Rican league.
Huh.
It's too small for my big hands, and it was just I didn't throw as many strikes as I should have.
Would that not? It's not a help, no.
I don't know. It was off. The seams are bigger. The ball's smaller. It wasn't great. It wasn't a great winter ball experience for me. I had fun. It was good. Lived on the beach, but did not pitch well. Okay. Get to the baseball talk.
Yeah.
All right.
Baseball tally.
Nah, the last email. Let's wrap it up.
All right, this one is from Drew Forsyth. When the Bengals drafted Ja'Marr Chase, PFF claimed it was the better pick when they could have drafted a tackle. I'm not debating that he was the better choice, though it seems like he is. But I will challenge the logic that Chase aided in Burrow's protection and that the teams only need average offensive lines. Burrow was sacked 70 times this season, a mere year after tearing his ACL and MCL. Riley Reiff clearly wasn't good enough to make the line average. Should the theory that wide receivers aid in pass protection be revisited? If not, why? Justify yourself.
I mean, they made it to the Super Bowl.
They did.
So the the goal of football is to win football games, right? Not to avoid being sacked.
Yeah.
So when we're calculating this concept, it's how do you maximize wins, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say adding Ja'Marr Chase helped the Bengals maximize their win total this year and had him a couple plays away from winning the Super Bowl. So that concept is justified. Now, the idea of like receivers protecting the offensive line, there's a couple things at play there. The offensive line was as bad as last year, a little bit worse.
Only by the end of it. Yeah.
Like, but again, they got wrecked by the Rams, which every offensive line does.
But like, so this is part of this, right? Riley, he says, Riley Reiff wasn't good enough to help to stop Joe Burrow getting murdered. Riley Reiff actually was. Riley Reiff was playing fine. The problem is,
he was also pass, but real quick, he was pass protecting worse than he had for whatever reason in the past, and then he got hurt.
But Riley Reiff gave up 21 pressures and 4 sacks in 12 games, right? Riley Reiff was okay. The problem is, when Riley Reiff went down, Isaiah Prince comes in, and Isaiah Prince gives up 5 sacks and 36 pressures and has a pass blocking grade of 39 and 11 penalties as well. He was a lot worse. So when when the guy you brought in to just not be a disastrous weak link goes down, you go back to being a disastrous weak link. And, you know, Hakeem Adeniji and Jackson Carmen were disastrous. Like, Adeniji gave up 9 sacks at guard, which is horrific. Jackson Carmen, if anything, was worse when he came in. So, and he was a guy that you drafted, right? So remember, the debate was never just Sewell or Chase. It's Sewell plus whoever you're going to draft in the second round versus Chase and whoever you're going to draft in the second round. They pick Chase. They grab an offensive lineman. The guy they drafted was Jackson Carmen. So part of this equation is you had a shot to get an offensive lineman, and that's the guy you picked, and he wasn't good, at least in year one, right? Same thing, you kind of reverse engineer the same thing. If you draft Sewell, who do you take in the second round at receiver? You know, you still have the chance. Like, this is why this whole thing was complicated and nuanced, and nobody had any idea what the right answer was, right? Because it was way too complicated to plot out all of those different threads of this thing and figure out exactly what the right answer was. But my initial point is that offensive line, when it was healthy, when they had the 5 guys starting that were supposed to be starting all season long,
was better.
It still wasn't good, but it was better. And it was a lot closer to, like, you can manage this than, oh, this is going to get Joe Burrow killed.
Yeah.
By the end of the season,
the offense got a lot better using the strategy of draft Chase and try to creep back toward average on the offensive line.
By the Super Bowl, it was back to the group it was last year, which is the right side of this thing is a catastrophe. Like, this, we just don't have enough players to block the guys we're going up against. And, oh, by the way, we're going up against Aaron Donald and Von Miller. So the things that are terrible are going to be exposed in a massive way.
Yeah, I think so. I think it worked. I mean, the strategy has worked because they won a lot of football games.
But so
it's happening.
Yeah. Point one, I think the offensive line was better than it looked or than it was by the end of the year. Point number two is, and this is why, again, this is a point we brought up at draft time, that you have to factor in the way Joe Burrow plays the game to that decision, right? Yikes. To the Ja'Marr Chase versus Penei Sewell thing. And Joe Burrow skews towards A, holding onto the ball longer than a lot of guys, and B, getting himself into trouble when pressure arrives, in terms of a huge volume of his pressure results in sacks, way more than a lot of other quarterbacks. So he finished the season, 27% of his pressured plays became sacks. Josh Allen, I think, was under 10% admittedly the only quarterback in the NFL under 10%.
But you want to be in that. You want to be like 15% or
up. Yeah. If you're under between 10 and 15%, you're in a good place. So if you're at 27%, you are way over those other guys. But the point is, part of the dynamic was, is Ja'Marr Chase going to help Joe Burrow get rid of the ball quickly, mitigate pressure in that way? I would say that part didn't happen. So his average time to throw didn't get any faster. The volume of quick plays didn't really get any faster. What did happen is that when Burrow got into trouble, he defaulted to that effort, Chase is down there somewhere, and started throwing the ball in his general direction. And that did help, because Burrow, right, suddenly his grade went through the roof under pressure. He was one of the best graded quarterbacks in the NFL under pressure. So it actually didn't help him avoid getting killed anymore, but it helped him at least, if I'm going to get killed, I might as well complete a pass here. That was the difference that Chase made.
All right, I see people in the comments talking about sack totals and what Penei Sewell gave up and everything. I'm just going to, longtime listeners know this, but I'm going to reiterate. Just like I said, don't use coverage stats in lieu of our grade for coverage. Do not use sacks allowed by an offensive lineman. I know you used it to make a point, but just don't do it. Because the result, after a bad block, is driven by things outside of the offensive lineman's control. Just is. Joe Burrow needs, if Joe Burrow, we said the same thing about Russell Wilson last year. We said the same thing about Deshaun Watson. If you want to get sacked less, it's as much on Burrow as it is the offensive line. If you want to get pressured less, it's more on the offensive line than Burrow. So Burrow's got probably something to, there's something that probably needs to either change in his game, or you just have to deal with. Just like Russ, just like Aaron Rodgers, just like other quarterbacks who got sacked a lot. Now, Russ, a lot of his is pocket manipulation and rolling out too much or whatever it is. With Burrow, you know, if you go back through some of the sacks even the other night, there were open receivers. There's a first read that maybe he had a chance to get rid of the ball. That's where he probably – you have to find that balance is what I'm saying, of getting rid of the ball quickly and then holding the ball to create a big play, much like Russell Wilson, much like Aaron Rodgers and other quarterbacks have had to deal with. So if you want the sack total to come down, it's probably half get better blockers and half make Joe Burrow make quicker decisions and or have other receivers who get open quickly and don't just get open down the field.
The point that I will concede, at least in terms of this specific case study, is that Ja'Marr Chase did not accelerate Joe Burrow's process. Which is something that can happen. I'm not conceding the point entirely in terms of it's not a thing that can help. You can definitely improve pass protection and how quickly the offense works and offset bad offensive linemen that way. It just didn't happen this year. So the idea that Ja'Marr Chase was going to come in and the speed with which he wins was going to mean that Joe Burrow's average time to throw was 0.2 seconds faster, and therefore he would be under pressure, whatever percentage less that is, that part didn't happen. But what did happen is that Chase provided Burrow a place to go with the ball when he was under pressure. And that did have an obvious and measurable effect, that when he was under pressure, Burrow was significantly better this year, in part because anytime he got into trouble, he was just like, where's Chase? There's the ball, right? So it did have an effect. And then the other thing is that, yeah, like the offensive line was actually better, and it's still a work in progress. Like, the idea here is to get five guys to an average standard. They didn't do that. They got maybe two guys to an average standard, 2.5 if you count Reef before he went down. And then when Reef went down, all of a sudden you've got three guys that aren't at the required standard. So this is the thing. Like, this is what the Bengals now need to spend the entire offseason doing. They need to repeat what the Chargers did last year and attack that offensive line and find three new starters at least.
I'd also say, I think we were probably saying at the time, I don't think the Bengals went hard enough in free agency. And I'll bring up like Matt Filer, who the Chargers got. I mean, if you just added a Matt Filer to this and he was starting at right guard for you, and Riley Reiff was your starting right tackle, it's one position. But that would make a huge difference. If Filer and Reef are the starters at right guard and right tackle, Joe Burrow only gets sacked 5 times probably instead of 7. So there you go. Completely changes the game in the Super Bowl. So, yeah, there's still work to do on the offensive line. But if you told Bengals fans a year from now, you're going to draft – it doesn't matter. You're going to be in the Super Bowl and a few plays away. Yeah, And if and it was like, Ja'Marr Chase is going to be the guy that's going to help you get it. Like, yeah, of course, you're sprinting to the podium to make that pick.
Right. But if you go back to, and revisit the Sewell versus Chase discussion again, right? Obviously, Chase made a massive difference to that offense. He made Burrow better. He made T. Higgins better. He made the overall offense better. He had a massive impact and was really responsible for them winning a bunch of games this year, like individually responsible. Remember when they played the Ravens and he just eviscerated,
took over,
new friend of the show, Marlon Humphrey, right?
Yeah, can't trash him anymore. No, we love Marlon. He's been great.
Right, but like he just rocked up and just beat that guy every way, shape, or form, right? And that guy's, he's an elite cornerback, and Chase just wrecked him. So he made a massive difference. Now you're saying, you look at Penei Sewell, he graded really well as well, particularly when he switched to right tackle. His pass blocking grades were very good for the second half of the year on. He would have been an upgrade over Riley Reiff, and presumably would have stayed healthy, so he would have been an even bigger upgrade over Isaiah Prince at right tackle. But would that have made, would the upgrade from Reiff and then Prince to Sewell have made the same impact as Chase? I don't think so. Like, I simply don't think it would have had the same impact. Then you start looking, all right, second round, if you've drafted one of those guys, like, who is your next player? Who's the next guy that you're going to bring up? And that's where it starts to get really interesting.
For receivers?
Yeah, so they picked number 46 overall. The guy they went with was Jackson Carman. If you're looking at, like, the next offensive lineman off the board, they could have picked Samuel Cosmi. That probably would have been a better pick. They had an option of Dylan Raduns was still there. Creed Humphrey. I mean, you know, if you'd had foresight and grabbed Creed, who went,
I think we had all those guys ahead of Jackson Carman on our board.
Right. So there were players there that would have made a bigger impact than the Jackson Carman deal, which again would have made it even more swung towards Ja'Marr Chase. Is that the only? Obviously, you know, you go even further down, you get guys like Trey Smith, who was being overlooked and fell, and blah blah. But you could have grabbed guys that were better options than Jackson Carman. Then if you look at receiver and you say, all right, instead, let's say they took Penei Sewell instead, who is going to be your Ja'Marr Chase from this point on? And it's not a great list. Rondale Moore went after that point. Eskridge, Tutu Atwell, Terrace Marshall, those are the next receivers off the board. Then you got to go down to Josh Palmer, Deami Brown. So you can
Tutu Atwell, by the way, he's the top pick for the Rams. He didn't play football this year.
Yes. So you can make a pretty compelling argument that just in terms of the players that were left, they made the right call. Like if you take those two options and you say, all right, we draft Ja'Marr Chase, there's actually quite a few offensive linemen left that were going to make an impact. You draft Penei Sewell, all of a sudden when you're picking a wide receiver, it's not a group that's making a huge impact.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. It was the right pick. We're talking about wins, not necessarily fixing sack totals. We want to fix the sack total now, but we're trying to maximize wins, and that's what I think Ja'Marr Chase does for the Bengals. Some people are saying we're talking too much Bengals, but all we're doing is these are just jumping off points for discussion, and it is the best time of the year to have great offseason NFL discussions.
Yes, and also, you know, the Super Bowl wrap the season did, that was one of the biggest talking points of the entire offseason and season. And now it's done, right? Now we've officially declared the Bengals correct for drafting Ja'Marr Chase. Now we'll never talk it again. It will never come up ever more.
It'll never come up. Les Snead is at the parade with his...
I bet he is.
With the meme.
With the meme? How is he with the meme?
He's got a picture t-shirt? Of his face on a t-shirt with the F them picks over it.
The smartest thing Les could do at this point is perpetuate the idea that that's what they do. And make everybody else, like, don't right. jump 2 feet into that strategy.
Right. Like, we're not even meeting draft meetings this year. We're going to save money.
Right.
Like, I will say there's other parts to the Rams strategy that is fascinating. First, they do slightly different things from a scouting standpoint. I think they take a lot of input from their coaching staff. They're very team-oriented with how they do things. They have a pretty good analytics department. Sarah Bailey heads that up. She does a good job kind of overseeing a lot of the stuff they do. They have front office front office people that listen to the PFF NFL podcast. That's another way that they're probably, you know, staying informed and winning Super Bowls. You know, it's a lot of outside-the-box thinking over there in Los Angeles, and now they're having a parade. Look at them. Some of our fans, they're probably not watching live right now because they're at the parade. That's why the YouTube numbers are a little bit lower.
Are they?
Because the Rams are at the parade.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why. Anyway, NFL Pod, that promo code, it's there. It's for you. Draft Guide has 316 pages. Go get it. 25% off using the promo code NFL Pod, NFL P-O-D. It's the time of year. You get 365 days of access. You get the Draft Guide. If you want fantasy tools and all that stuff, just sign up here in February. Get your 25% off. Get it for the whole year. And little trick, if you do sign up today, you'll pretty much get two draft guides for the price of one, because next year the draft guide will be out at this point. So you'll have this year's and next year's within that 1 year of subscription. So get your 25% off using NFL Pod.
Very sneaky.
Right? All right, guys. Appreciate it. We're going to be back tomorrow. And we've got Brad Spielberger from PFF. He's going to join us. And we are going to talk all things free agency. Brad is our contract expert. And he's got contract projections for all the top free agents. He helped him and Sam and I and a couple others put our top 200 free agents together. So we're going to break it all down and officially once again kick off the offseason with some free agent talk.
That's good.
All right. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.